Welcome to episode 26 of Redesigning Cities, the Speedwell Foundation Talks at Georgia Tech. I'm your host, Ellen Dunham Jones. I'm a professor in the School of Architecture here at Georgia Tech, where I direct the Master of Science in Urban Design degree. Today's episode, Redesigning Cities for Local Entrepreneurs, will feature two remarkable entrepreneurs who consider themselves more as farmers than as real estate developers. Their incremental improvements seed the ground for affordable local solutions to help residents and more entrepreneurs revive neighborhoods. Monty Anderson and Bernice Radel hope that their work will inspire you to do the same in your neighborhood and engage in what they call gentlification instead of gentrification. Bernice bought her first building in her neighborhood in Buffalo at age 25 for a dollar. Today, she's owner of Buffalo Development and Little Wheel Restoration Company, and has been featured on HGTV, the New York Times, Huffington Post, Preservation Magazine, and TEDx. She has a BS in Urban Planning and has won an award from the National Trust for Historic Preservation. She sits on Buffalo's Zoning Board and on the boards of the Incremental Development Alliance and Form-Based Codes. Monty Anderson is a leader and founder of the Incremental Development Movement. Sharing what he's learned as president of Options Real Estate Investments, Inc., working in Southern Dallas and Northern Ellis counties in Texas. I've long been fascinated by his re-inhabitation of dead strip malls with more community-serving uses and his creative solutions to non-subsidized affordable housing. He's won many awards for this work, but most of all, he's helped to revive communities.
It's really great to be here today to talk about gentrification and not gentrification. Here in Dallas, here's from the Dallas Morning News, just to start us right out. You know, West Oak Cliff, which is that part of the city, the have-nots, the plan obviously shows that Dallas has no clue how to fight gentrification. And it's really true. It's a sad state here, what's going on. You know, my past is one of the things that a farmer, a developer like us does, is you commit to a place forever. And so I've served on city councils, and I've served on different chambers of commerce, and really became a community activist many years ago before I became a developer. And so I've been doing this a little over 30 years now. One of the things that we talk about is this farming flywheel. And this is where every person in the community can actually get involved. This is not just for the small developer. It takes a whole community to do this kind of work. So this is some of the projects that I've been involved in. It's a wide range from anywhere from boutique hotel to the infamous Texas Theater where Oswald was captured after he allegedly shot President Kennedy, to small homes and mixed-use projects here. The farmer here, you know, he knows everything. He or she knows everything. You know, they know when the weather's changing or when a hurricane's coming, when climate change and financial change are both like really serious right now. And if you're not ready for both of them, if you're not prepared and looking forward, and Bernice and I talk about this a lot, you're going to be in trouble. And so this farmer here, he's thinking right now of what's coming ahead, what kind of bugs, you know, what he's got to do to his land, what he's got to do to take care of his community here. And just like the farmer knows everything about his field or his farm, we're the same way in the communities that we commit our lives to. So if it takes a village to raise a child, it really takes a whole community to build or rebuild a building. And this is just some of the people in my team, but it's bankers and city staff and it's partners, it's title company people, it's agents and maintenance people and contractors and loan brokers and attorneys and CPAs. You know, it takes all of these people to do a deal like we do. There's no way that we can have all the knowledge to do this. And so anybody considering getting into this business, just realize that you put your team together and this is how you raise your knowledge up, is by putting the right team together. So when I want to talk about this little beautiful street here in Dallas, this street was owned by one family, and you can see there's duplexes and fourplexes and apartments, and right in the middle down the street, there's an orange house where the family used to live. And this family decided they wanted to sell their property that was started by their grandfather. And instead of breaking it up and selling it to small entrepreneurs, okay, the locals, because that's what gentrification is. See, gentrification is when the locals get the ownership, when the locals get the benefit. It's not where the big developers or the big REITs or the big corporations come from out of town and take the land and do what they do to it, which I call financial architecture. And so in this case here, they could have took this, sold it in pieces to locals. They would have made a whole lot of money. But instead, this is what they did. And so you go from people that could have owned properties to people that rent properties that are one bedrooms for $1,600, $1,700 a month. So this little lady right here, see, she was a housekeeper at my hotel, and I helped her start her own business. Instead of working for us to making $12 an hour, she now has her own housekeeping business. And this is her house. So we take somebody that was making $10 or $12 an hour, they start their own business, they take an old house, and now we help her rebuild this house, where now you've got a real local owner, you got real culture, you got real people like in your neighborhood. And they're working people, working class people that have wealth. So you might take something like this. This is an old post office. You know, you rip the roof off and put a couple apartments on top. Again, this could be very much an owner occupant, whether you live there or whether your office is, like my office is downstairs and I own this building and I have two apartments upstairs. And so very easily, this could be done with an SBA loan if you're putting your business here, or an FHA loan if you're living here. So here's another little property here. This is a 2,700 square foot property, less than $500,000, brand new, which got two 900 square foot spaces in the front. And it's one story, so it doesn't have the apartments on top. It's got them in the back. So it's all one story, two 400 square foot apartments in the back. And so this building now is owned by the barber there, the guy in the purple shirt there. He was a 30-year-old barber who's now running a barber school, who now owns this building with rental properties. He's got some of his students actually live in the apartments. He owns three barber shops, a barber school, several commercial properties and residential properties right now. He's 34 years old now, and he's teaching all these young kids how to do the same thing he is. And by the way, he still cuts hair. So he still stays close to his craft. So he's close to his craft, but now he's building wealth for his family. And he was raised by a single mom from Mexico. And so that's the kind of thing that is what gentrification is. Look at this Costco on the freeway right down the road. It's on the tax rolls for $8.75 million, and it's 16 acres. And if you divide those 16 acres by 8.75, you get $532,000 per acre. And look at all the roads around that Costco. Look at all the infrastructure, all the taxpayer-paid infrastructure keeping this thing going. Now, let's look at these two little buildings we just looked at on Main Street. The first one, the orange one, is on the tax rolls for $2.2 million an acre. Okay, the second one, the one story, is on the tax rolls for $3.1 million an acre. So you see, if you build up a whole lot of these little entrepreneurial-owned, locally-owned buildings, you have a wealthy city. If you do it the other way, eventually you have a city that's bankrupt. We took this old school. This was an alternative school that the Dallas Independent School District had in a part of town that hadn't had any investment in like 70 years. And so what we needed here was we needed small entrepreneurial spaces, and we needed spaces where people could work or live. And this is what it looks like today. We took those windows and we turned them into storefronts. And so this is a place where you can get a small space for a barber, or a restaurant, or a tattoo parlor, or a nutrition place, and you can get a small space, and you can pay less than $1,000 a month, but the price per square foot is high enough where it makes it work for a developer. And on the second floor is work-live units. And these work-live units, as you can see, these are small spaces. They don't have restrooms in each of the space. They're built like dorms, where the restrooms and the showers are in the hall. Now, they're still private, so you can live here, you can work here, you can start your business by living in your space, working in there if you're creating sculptures or whatever you want to do, braids, or you know, you're an Herbalife. We've got a coffee office here. We've got all those kinds of things. We've got a real estate company. Those are the kind of tenants we got here. So where can you get 265 square feet and have a store, have a sign on the street? And this is one of those places you can do that. So again, by downsizing the space, you can keep the prices affordable and get the square foot price up. So here's one of our developments here, built one at a time. As you can see, that donut shop, you know, that's 1200 square foot with an apartment on the back. We built this old school. Then we built the brown building next, and then the blue one with the red awning, and then the orange brick, and then the three fourplexes with 700 square foot apartments up on top, mixed in with development of cottages and even an independent pharmacy. All of these properties are owned by local people. So there's no way a big developer or a big REIT is going to come along and really be able to buy this stuff up. So this is an unsubsidized homeless housing. It's called the Roommate House. And it was a solution to homeless people coming out of shelters, having their own space. And as you can see, the top part of the drawing is two bedrooms and a living room and a kitchen. And then you've got these two roommate units connected onto the back. Price of this back then, today, this would be over $200,000. The price back then was about $110 a square foot to rehab this two-bedroom house and add the two rooms on it. And what we were getting in Dallas at the time, we were getting, we're getting lots of money donated. But they were giving away houses which weren't working very well because people that got those houses didn't take care of them. And so the money was used here as a loan at 2%. So an ex-homeless person owns this house. As you can see here, they're paying $527 a month plus taxes and insurance. And then they're renting out the two roommate units for $250 a piece. Here, modernizing what we call suburban sprawl. Here's a 3,000 square foot house on an acre of land with a pool. And you can see it's in really bad condition. And this is four different people living in this house, which makes it very affordable for a family, but not living together. And just with a little bit of work, you can see you've got something here that looks really good. We look at places all over the country. The problem is affordable housing. So you've got to look at real estate differently these days. You've got to be able to look at it more than one dimensional. You've got to be able to look at it from all around. So with that, I'm going to pass it on to Bernice to take it from here.
Yeah, thank you, Monty. I've owned Buffalo now for 10 years. I've been doing this on my own with a big team, of course, for 10 whole years. Okay, I always say I'm just a little lady with a dollar and a dream, and that farming, as we talk about, is a long game. No matter where you are, if you're in Atlanta, if you're in a small town outside of Atlanta, if you're in Buffalo or Detroit or Dallas, it's where you invest your love, you invest your life. And that is truly, if you do not love the place you live, if you do not love these houses and the people around you, it's love that often gets us through during the very challenging times. It's not easy to do this work, but it's super fulfilling over time. So this is a map of like my farm. I live in Buffalo, New York. I'm on the west side of Buffalo primarily. Everything and anything I do is by bike. I have an urban planning degree, so I'm kind of a planning nerd. I literally, if I didn't have to drive in a car anytime, I wouldn't. It's everything is around me. I live, I work, and I build and renovate here in Buffalo, New York, within my neighborhood. This is a basically one of our projects that I call Foibles. And this is us removing storefront for the first time in literally 60 plus years, because thanks to our zoning code, the Buffalo Green Code, little legacy buildings are now legal in residential neighborhoods. Yet again, first time in 60 years. But here's a project I wanted to talk about. There are three units, technically two residential, one cute little storefront. And thanks to the change of our zoning code, I was able to bring this building back to life in full and basically be an outlet for a tenant of mine who wanted to start her own pie shop. And I want to talk about how we made this work, because as Monty said, you have to get creative. Those two apartments are able to pay basically the mortgage and the taxes and all the other things. And we were able to allow a pie shop to come in at an extremely affordable rate, all because I did work on the weekends and painted it myself with the help of friends. And we thought really creatively about how essentially code hack this building. Sadie, she's the owner of the pie shop. I asked Sadie one question. I said, can you cook with electric instead of gas? And Sadie was like, well, sure, I could do electric. And I go, great, because now we don't have to do a $80,000 sprinkler system. And you know, I can keep your rent at like $525 a month instead of being $1,000 a month, which you know, so important to her and her business and the thriving of her business. And that's really important to say, you know, how is this a win-win-win for everybody, right? My mortgage is still paid. The apartments are still affordable. They're like market rate-ish, a little bit below that. And Sadie is able to start her pie shop at a very affordable rate and come in and actually give something cool to the community, like vegan pie and coffee is awesome. And she lives right down the road and she, you know, she shovels the sidewalk and takes care of the properties. And that's really important. And so we take that philosophy, the do well by doing good philosophy, into everything we do. And I want to kind of throw a couple projects out there. This was a house I bought it from the land bank, bought it, renovated it, and we sold it to a first-time home buying couple off market in the middle of COVID when prices would have been $30,000, $40,000 over market. We were able to meet in the middle, waive fees, make it happen for their budget at $189,000 for a brand new fully renovated house. And that may sound like a lot, but that is like an $1,100 mortgage, which is less than what they were paying for rent. And we wanted to meet with them where they are. We worked it out. They got what they needed within their budget, and we were able to make it work within our budget. Even though I could have sold this for probably $210,000 all day. 585, this is my office building. We did this gigantic mural to the Latino community. We wanted to make sure that they felt safe and that this neighborhood, as it changes, is welcoming to the people that live there. This building is 11 units. I'm able to keep the rents at $550 a month to $850 a month with zero subsidy on this project. Zero. Why? Because they're really cute. They're really simple. I control basically every aspect of it. I do all the construction. We do the property management. We take care of the residents. And because I was able to get some creative financing from a partner investor who really cares about affordable housing. So inspired by Monty, we took this downtown Main Street building and cut up the main space and turned it into 12 different tiny storefronts, basically for small businesses. Almost every single one of my small businesses are women, and the majority of them are Black women. And I think this is so cool. We rent spaces out for $375 to $650 a month. The Huntress, again, same concept. I was able to renovate these apartments. This is right down the street from me right now. Renovate these. There are two Black-owned businesses. One was a popcorn shop, the other a nail salon. Each of these rents was $650. And then this is a project we're working on right now. Buffalo Double was a sign of wealth. You had your own apartment and then you rented out the other apartment either to family or friends. If you buy a double for $200,000 and you can rent the other apartment out for $800,000 to $900,000 a month, your mortgage is essentially paid for, which means you're building wealth in other ways. You're saving money for your children. You're saving money for retirement. You're investing money in whatever is you want to, right? You can start to build generational wealth that transcends you. And that's very important. So with this project, we took two doubles, turned them into triples. So the top apartment is like the family apartment, four bedroom, super big, super beautiful. And then the first floor are two apartments, one bedroom and one two bedroom. Why? Nanny, grandmother can take the one bedroom and the two bedroom can be rented out. Maybe you want to Airbnb one, you want to rent the other one out. Maybe you go from a big family down and you want to downsize to a two bedroom and you rent the big one out. Either way, it doesn't matter. The point is that it's a flexible housing choice for people over time. Monty and I and another friend of ours in South Bend have started this project this year called Neighborhood Evolution. And Monty has this beautiful 12-step process that we've been working through. 12 steps in neighborhood development.
Yeah. See, here, this is where you may be one of these people. This could be anybody in a community. So we think that community development ought to be done by lots of different people, which is the way it was 100 years ago or so. That's where the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker owned property and had a couple of rental units. And in this case here, if you start off with farming and your step one and two, which is the most important thing, is committing to the place, committing to your neighborhood. And then if you go from there, it's into acquisitions, which you use lenders and CPAs and attorneys and asset managers. They're who that's the people in acquisitions. And then once you acquire, you're into improvements. That's architects, planners, trades, carpenters, plumbers, sheetrockers. See, sheetrockers shouldn't be eliminated from being developers also, right? A sheetrocker, a painter. And then on to when you're finished and you've got leasing and selling with real estate agents and marketing people, and then into property management, maintenance people, janitors, bookkeepers, and then you repeat the process again.
When we think about the 12 steps, Monty and I have been trying to teach people, talk to people, give them the confidence to do this as much as possible. There are major capital companies like Blackstone, or I forget the name, that are buying $50,000 properties at a time. You know, these are huge impacts in our local communities, and we only really solve them if we have many people that own. You know, we've been doing a lot of work in South Bend, Indiana. They just won a major award from the Form-Based Code Institute about their zoning code. Our colleague Mike Keene has been really active doing building there, and we've been working like one-on-one with developers, small-scale developers there. Each one of the people that's involved in this, it's a lifetime level commitment, or at least 10 years or so. So when you have 30 people in a room, all that are giving their all, the energy that comes through is so magical, right? Everyone starts believing in South Bend again.
Yeah. Look at this guy, this picture to the top. There, one of the guys is the economic development guy in South Bend. And the lady that's sitting in the window, it's this conversation here. She did not own that building. She was an art maker space. And we taught her how to own this building, how to negotiate. She bought a strip center. And today she owns about a 12,000 square foot strip center with four or five tenants in it. And she's got her space there. This is how the local middle class, I think, can build wealth again. And that's the way this country was built.
But I hope y'all realize that you can do this.
Thank you both so much. I think it's really interesting what you say about ownership. And I want to focus on you, Bernice. Tell us more about how did you get started in this?
Well, I wanted to get a job in real estate. So I started minimum wage as a maintenance coordinator, coordinating toilet complaints and no heat calls. I did the largest energy retrofit in the city of Buffalo's history in the middle of the recession, 2008, 9, 10, 11. It was 16 buildings, 250 units. We did boilers, roofs, windows were necessary, all multifamily, all historic. And I managed all those subs. I was like 22 years old. And so, and I was just really dedicated. I didn't really know. I just asked a lot of questions, and I was still going to school full time, going for my urban planning degree. But then what happened, and this is important to know, and I would have never predicted this. I wanted to start my own development company because they were tearing down buildings in my neighborhood. But I said to myself, well, I don't have any money, but I'm smarter than these developers. They just have money. I don't have money. So I started my own little LLC. I created a little vision statement and I made this cute little logo. And I said, I'm going to figure this out. And I was at a conference in Boston, talking about my energy retrofit work, because by this time people were like, who the hell is this girl in Buffalo doing these major renovations? And I was like, I mean, I'm little, but I was also 22 at the time. They were like, what is this girl doing? Right. And in that moment of me talking about the buildings that I was doing, I said, took the opportunity. I said, if you really care about the earth and climate change, and you want to care about energy efficiency, like you need to come over to Buffalo and start investing. All these buildings are being torn down. I challenge you to come and help me. And in that crowd was one person who worked in real estate in Brooklyn, New York, and literally came up to me at the bar afterwards and said, hey, I was like really compelled by your story. I'd love to help you. And I just followed up with him. And we are still partners to this day. 585 Niagara Street building, he was able to angel invest money. So we were able to keep the rents as affordable as possible. It was half luck, but it was a lot of hard work. And I think it's important to say, if you really put yourself out there, there is money available for your projects. And there are people who want to invest in you, but you have to meet them halfway. You have to show that you're willing to do this and work.
Monty, you've done a little work in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. Tell us what you thought was applicable. We're a kind of booming economy, but perhaps more like Dallas. We still have all those bypass neighborhoods and things.
But Atlanta and Dallas are really similar because we've got a lot of suburban sprawl. You know, we've got a lot of those neighborhoods that were built in the 60s and So not everything has to be a, we show a lot of small housing today and a lot of small retail, but not everything has to be that small. I mean, retrofitting these big shopping centers, you know, that were built in the 50s and 60s, well, actually even built in the malls and things built in the 80s and 90s, you know, they're going to have to be retrofitted. You got these sprawling houses like the 3,000 square foot house that I showed. You've got sprawling shopping centers. You've got the first ring suburbs, which had better shopping centers, I think, than the later ones that are on the freeway, where at least the neighborhoods connected to those. The neighborhoods are connected to those and surrounding those. So those can be repaired easier than the power centers. If I look at a single family house and I say, it's a single family house, I got to buy it cheap and I'm going to flip it or I'm going to lease it or whatever, then you got thousands of people looking at it the same way. Same way with a shopping center. But when you start to take those shopping centers and you cut them up differently and you can put, you know, I'm doing one right now that we're putting residential, you know, 51 units on the in the middle of a parking lot of a shopping center. Or if you're taking a big manufacturing plant and you divide it up into to small like studios and like TikTok, it's the TikTok era, right? It's photographers and filmmakers and music, you know, and not just recording studios, but rehearsal studios, places for people to collaborate, you know, co-working in offices. If you look at office, how big is your office today? This is how big your office is. And then, you know, 20 years ago, our office was, you know, credenzas and conference tables. And now mm-hmm. we're into co-working. But to make co-working work, how do you make that work? You got to put the secret sauce in it, which is really what we are as farmers, why we keep talking about being farmers. You have to immerse yourself into it. Lisa and I, one thing that we are the exact same. We do leasing. We do property management. We do construction. We do development. We'll raise our own money. So we're in that flywheel. We're in the middle of it. It's not a pyramid chart where we're the CEOs. We're the working middle. You know, one of the things that I'm always thinking is how can people get more money or how can they live more quality? Maybe it's a little bit smaller, but that's where Dallas, where Bernice used to could buy a house for a dollar. She can't buy those anymore. In Atlanta and Dallas, we never could buy them for a dollar.
Right.
So, but we have to look differently. We cannot look at it the same as we did in getting to where we're at today.
If the roof costs $20,000, but the house costs $10,000, you're not going to invest the $20,000. You know, we had to create value with nothing. Like I had to plant 100 tulips every year to get my neighborhood to feel more beautiful in the spring. Like it was like, because that's all I could afford was 100 tulip bulbs.
And Bernice is right. It's all relevant. It may be cheap, but she can only get cheap rent too. So
I can't get any loans, right? Yeah. So I couldn't get a loan for the first 7 years of doing this work. Everything had to be cash. Where do you find the cash? Okay, let's start there. So it's like, it's just a different level of pressure, but I really encourage you to not get discouraged by that, because whether you're in Atlanta, Dallas, Buffalo, Detroit, there's money, but there's also loan products, which we do teach a lot about. There's loan products out there for people for different types of buildings, which we can't get into today, but just know that it is possible, you know, to figure out a path.
So, how do you actually select which building you're going to buy and who are you typically buying from?
I always get vacant properties that are ignored, but I would say land banks, like the land bank, you know, that's all kinds of.
When people know that you care about your neighborhood, they tend to, you know, especially I've had older people call me and just say, I want to sell this to you. I don't mm-hmm. want to sell it to the other guy. The money doesn't matter. And that is such a good way to buy rather than having to bet. I'm always looking at what could be. See, when you're a farmer, you're responsible for the whole neighborhood. So whether you own it or not, you're always dreaming of what it can be.
One of the things that you have to do in this industry, like, is listen. You have to just hear what people are saying. So you'll hear, oh, we don't have a laundromat. Okay, well, let's figure that out. Or we really need coffee, right? Or whatever. And so you hear these, and then you may connect the building that you see in for sale with the need. And all of a sudden you're like, okay, let's do a nail salon because there's nowhere to get your nails done in my neighborhood.
So, you know, I loved when you guys spoke about, or Monty, you talked specifically about that it's so important for more people to own, have the ability to own rather than rent, be stuck in the perpetual rent. There's nothing wrong with renting if that's what you're choosing, but if you're being forced. And only have that as the option, that's a real problem. So how do you avoid gentrification? I love that, you know, Monty, you showed the map with all the little buildings clustered in a neighborhood that you're working on. I mean, I definitely agree with the idea that having more local ownership is a very, sets a dip, very, raises all boats more, much more than the typical sort of big developer gentrification that we see. But is it another form of, where's that line? Does gentrification eventually become gentrification, or what do you think?
Well, it's not only about the affordable housing, but if I can empower you with wealth or owning your own business, or if not everybody's an entrepreneur, right? And not everybody wants to own. And there's nothing wrong with leasing. In fact, leasing is not always the worst thing. I mean, you don't want to be a fool and buy something too expensive, you know? But here's a couple of things I say. Here's how you stop gentrification. You don't allow the super blocks to be done. No super blocks. Leave the lot small. Put a lid on it. Mm-hmm. Do not allow these six story. Keep a lid on it at two story, three, whatever you want. Access to capital, you know, financing and access to equity for small entrepreneurs. See, today the federal regulations of banking are the same for Bernice and I in Dallas and in Buffalo as they are for the big, you know, real estate investment trust. The regulation that the regulators look at our banks. And so our banks, even though they want to loan us 100% of the money or 90% or give us good terms, they can't because the law doesn't allow you to do that. Yeah. So how do you put together an investor deal? That's part of the gentrification where you have the right investors. So I went to a billionaire one time to get investment capital and they were terrible. But what I found was a lot better was the local baby boomer who had $1 million or $2 million in cash that they'd saved up from working at AT&T or teaching for 30, 40 years. They had saved. If we could bridge those gaps with connecting with people like Bernice and younger entrepreneurs, and then you can also know what you're doing, how to put together the package where you understand what a banker thinks like or what the planning and zoning, what they're thinking like. What's going on at City Hall? You know, what are those things getting involved?
You know, ask yourself, does your zoning code allow mega blocks? You know, like the City of Buffalo Green Code, we do not. You cannot have more than 120 feet long project. You have to, your project can be three stories, up to five, you know, and there's some transit, some along the rail line that goes up a little higher, but you can't do those mega blocks. And if you're thinking, well, how do I avoid mega blocks? Well, does your zoning code allow it, right? So you could make a change there if that's your strong suit, right? And that's, I guarantee you, probably 90% of Americans, of the codes in America, allow 300 feet wide buildings, right? So, and we see them in new codes, new form-based codes will say, oh, you can allow 300 feet wide buildings. It's like, what? That's a mega block. That's only going to be for what Monty just said. The REITs, the big billionaires will invest in those, not local people.
You know, buildings built for the finance, not for humans. But we have this saying, doing good and making money. So, you know, I'm a capitalist and I don't apologize for it, you know, because you have to make money and it's important. But doing good and making money, they're equal.
I'm going to start drawing on questions. How have you navigated the single family zoning laws when you are chopping up, especially like that, the sprawl suburban house into four units, and as well, Bernice, when you're turning the double into a three.
I think Bernice has got better zoning for sure in Buffalo than we do in Dallas. And we're starting to recognize what she's talking about there. But here, what we had to do is hack the code. If you took a house like I've done and you don't have an owner occupant in it, and you turn it into four units, rental units, and you have it on a small lot with four cars, you're going to attract attention and it's going to be bad for you. But I've tested this now with two cities, Duncanville and Dallas. If you're an owner occupant and you got separate spaces for family, I would call it family and friends. Not, you know, you may make a friend by renting to somebody, and you have the doors, there's lockable doors like hotel rooms that used to lock. And you don't have kitchens in those other units. You can't have kitchens in them. You can only have hot plates. But we can't have a grill out in the backyard. There is a grill out in the backyard. So there's one we call the shepherd. Okay, that'd be the owner occupant. And that's how this would work. This doesn't work for developers going out there and saying, I'm going to chop these up and I'm going to turn them into apartments. That's not going to work. That's not what the roommate house is. Okay. And you're going to get in trouble. It's not going to be good. And same thing's going on with Airbnb today. People that have an ADU, you know, an accessory dwelling unit in the backyard and renting it for Airbnb, that works because you're an owner there. When you start to take the house and the ADU and you start to turn them into hotel rooms, then eventually cities are all over saying, we're going to stop Airbnbs because of that, because people are changing whole neighborhoods into Airbnb. And so those are the things you got to do. You got to have the lockable door. It's got to be part of the house, you know. But this way, this is really like co-housing.
Yeah. And I know in parts of California, in Los Angeles, a residential unit is defined by the number of kitchens.
Yeah, the code hacking part is what Monty's, the hot plate is not a kitchen because the kitchen is defined by a stove. And if there's no stove, and you know, we say hot plate, but these things are the new like broiler oven things are so fancy. You know, you basically can put even the turkey in the convection oven. Yeah, that's actually how we got the pie shop. She worked with convection ovens instead of gas, and we were able to to not do the sprinkler. So it's a similar thing to the city. They were like, okay, well, there's no grease, no gas, no flame. So you're able to save so much money, which then transfers to the tenants. Working in a city that has overhauled the zoning code is magic. All my buildings that I showed you are fully legal because we removed minimum parking requirements citywide.
Don't go out and build a tiny house community out in the middle of nowhere because you can't live small unless you got things to walk to.
Another question is, you know, how do you actually find your tenants? We know you've had successes. Have you also had some failures?
I mean, you have all kinds of different people that you're working with. And the more you do it, the more you're going to get good and bad experiences. That's important to start with. I hear what people hear, like what they want, but I also hear that this chef is looking for a space. And all of a sudden I'm like making the phone call. I'm like, hey, let's get you over here in this building, or I have a building. Would you want to come see it? So I think that you can find entrepreneurs by pop-ups, markets, farmers markets. That's where you start. Instagram. All those people are your tenants, potential tenants. You just communicating and working with people and building relationships over time. I mean, it's hard to say it out loud, but I've had people not pay, you know, they have to break the lease because something happens and then you're mad at each other, or the best scenario is you're trying to figure out how to get them out of it because they need, something's happening in their lives and you have to try to fill that space gently with, you know. And so we go through those often. I mean, our whole world is problem solving. Every single day we are problem solving. And a lot of it, to me at least, is with tenants and tenant needs.
You go back to the farming. When you're a farmer, you know everything. I mean, you know who's moving around and who's doing and who cooks the best biscuit or the best pie. You know where the best barber is. You know where all those things are. And so when somebody needs something, when you're a community activist, farmer, neighborhood evolver, town maker, like we are, champion of our cities, then everybody knows that. And they say, Monty, do you know of anything? Bernice, do you know of anything? And so we get those, literally, they just walk in the door, Ellen. And then you get lucky. Again, I say the luck, Bernice said she was lucky earlier. I think I'm really a lucky person too. Because we commit to what we do, the universe smiles on us, you know. And tortures us too, believe me. But the people just walk in, and that, you know, I have about nearly 500. I thought I had 450, but I have about 500 tenants, and that's a lot these days. And I'm very personally, I know a lot of them. I mean, I know them, and so I think that's really difference between the corporate, you know, the big corporate and that. And when you know that, you can sense the market. I can tell you way before what the experts are saying, the market analysts are saying. Mm-hmm. I can sense it. I can tell you when it's fixing. I can tell you right now we're going into a recession.
Oh, yeah.
And because of how many people can't pay,
yeah,
and working, and where manufacturers are losing their contracts, they're not getting as many, and lots of things. So you can really sense the market. And you know what to do. And if somebody said, Monty, I want you to build me out a 5,000 square foot restaurant today, I would say you're crazy. Mm-hmm. You want to build, you want me to build you a 1,000 square foot restaurant that you're self-serve and not very many wait staff? I would say, okay, we got something to talk about. So, you know, it's kind of that scale of what you do. Yeah. You know, those things that go, I don't want to get invested in a 5,000 square foot restaurant because they're likely to be out of business in a year. Likely.
And some of that gets to.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Bernice.
Well, I just wanted one thing. So one of my pushes for affordability and with commercial space or tenant space is exactly what Monty just said. Can you pay the rent when the world turns upside down? So when, if you don't allow your buildings and yourself to get too far out of control, then, and, you know, being conservative on helps in a weird way, right? People can afford a $400 a month rent. They can afford a $600 a month rent. Even when things get tight, they can still make that work. And so there's safety in that. And it's important to allow that to tell your, to, so I tend to renovate on a dime, right? But then I also have affordable, my apartments are much more affordable, but it's because I never want to overextend myself personally, mainly because I don't have the, like I've been evicted. Like I have, you know, we've grown up and I've dealt with that my own self. And so it's just important to not let yourself get away too far away from what you can control. And Mommy is right. Like we are seeing it. I don't want to scare anybody about a recession because that's not my job. I can't predict those things, but we do feel it, right? You say, okay, as soon as gas started rising, you see people paying, not maybe they don't pay the full 800 rent. They pay 300 and then another 200, right? You see these kind of changes. Or a year ago, I would have 20 people looking at a space. Now I might have 10, right? A commercial space or 5, really. So it's just different.
All right. I want to kind of close up with now a kind of the bigger picture. So Monty, you got into the property tax per acre. So really that question of what is the actual quantified benefit to the city, to the larger community in economic dollars. Mike Messner asks, have you done analysis on your property tax rates versus the nearby developers and versus suburbia? And, you know, in that sort of property tax and the property taxes per acre. So the rate in the acre kind of stuff. And
we've done it quite a bit. And in fact, Mike Keene up in South Bend and Neil Heller out of Portland, mm-hmm. who's a planner out of Portland, did it and did an analysis on South Bend. And it's just through the roof. I'll just say that.
Yeah.
Just through the roof. And our projects here, it's pretty traditional for most of the big shopping centers and big suburban developments to be like 400,000 to 500,000, 600,000 per acre. Whereas our stuff, all of it is in the millions per acre. And it's across the board. And they say, because we can't get sales tax records, those are private, they say that sales tax is similar.
So I've heard, you know, Joe Minicozzi has made a career out of this metric, property tax per acre. Mm-hmm. And Joe says that a lot of that has to do with the rate in the cities are always denser property. The appraisers will say that they always appraise denser property higher, that at a higher rate than the low density stuff, even though Joe says, well, why? And doesn't really get much of an answer.
Right.
So do you think it's the rate that you're being charged?
It's the comparable values in the market, the appraised values. It's not because they're denser. Well, they're denser because they take less property. Okay. Mm-hmm. So they take less property. They're more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the same with the residential versus a 3,000 square foot house on an acre of land that costs $600,000 or $700,000. And the sewer to get to that house and the road to get to that house is hugely expensive. Where my development is in town, in the town on really existing, a lot of existing infrastructure, the sewer lines are shorter from place to place.
Yeah.
The police can get to it easier. The fire can get to it easier. You know, the school, more kids go to the school without being traveled around the countryside on a bus. You know, it's based on the assessed value here. And of course, a commercial property is worth what it makes.
So just to put it in perspective, one of the buildings I posted, the one with the mural on it, like, for example, that's maybe 50 feet wide at the most. And it goes pretty deep. That's 11 units. I pay $10,000 a year in my taxes there. So, and roughly. And, you know, it's like, well, that little teeny tiny building based on $1,000, you know, and that's a lot of money for the city. I mean, they do nothing for me. They do, they have to snowplow like one corner, you know, nine times a year and have a little sewer. So it really does add up. I don't know about other places, but I know here in Erie County, in the city of Buffalo, we actually pay a county tax, and all of that tax goes towards county services, not city, because the county cannot afford to sustain the roads and everything else from the suburban tax.
Ellen, listen to this one. I got a 90,000 square foot shopping center that I'm my newest project on about, it's on about 7 acres. Okay, right just down the road, right by the city hall. It was on the tax rolls for $3 million. We just ran an analysis on it. It's now worth $17 million. When we put the 51 units of apartments on the parking lot, which we have plenty of parking, it's got to be worth $30 million. So with no new infrastructure and no, you know, just using what you got, repurposing what you got, we go from 3 million to 30 million overnight. And they say in this town that we're out of land. What they mean is there's no sprawling acreage that we can build 1 acre lots on in suburban lots. That's what they're saying when they say we're out of land.
You guys are a fount of knowledge. I hope you've inspired everyone who's listened here. Where should people go who want to learn even more?
If they want to contact me, they can go to my website, buffalovedevelopment.com, or you can go on Instagram, which is buffalovedevelopment, or you can look me up, Bernice Radel, on Instagram. You can find my stuff there too. So,
same with me. You can go to optionsre.com, but very soon, Bernice and my work and Mike Keene's work out of Inc. for Mill Development Alliance, you know, has evolved to the neighborhood. And so it's neighborhoodevolution.com. It's coming soon. This is the first time we've even announced it or talked about it openly. We're really talking about neighborhoods, where they're at today, where they need to evolve to. So, and we still say the little pie shop with two businesses above is still extremely important. You'll be able to find us there going forward at neighborhoodevolution.com.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And again, I really wish you could join us at the reception. You've been listening to episode 26 of Redesigning Cities, the Speedwell Foundation Talks at Georgia Tech. A video and podcast of this event will be posted to our website, arc.gotech.edu/redesigning-cities, where you can also check out the previous episodes.